Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking on a thinker who, I think it's fair to say, has a reputation for being, well, difficult. But his core mission, this search for what he called a right life, feels more urgent than ever.
It really does. We're plunging into Peter E. Gordon's book, Precarious Happiness, Adorno, and the Sources of Normativity. And this is a big one, because we're trying to solve the central riddle of Theodore Adorno's work.
And for you, our listener, who specifically asked for this, we're going to go methodically, chapter by chapter. We're basically going to trace Adorno's hidden ethical framework through Gordon's analysis.
It's quite a task. Adorno, active from 1903 to 1969, was just a colossal figure. I mean, a philosopher, sociologist, a major culture critic, musicologist.
And a composer himself. He left behind an unfinished opera. I always think that's so fascinating. His student, Jürgen Habermas, called him the only genius I ever encountered.
And that genius, that multifaceted legacy, is also what creates the problem we're talking about today. Adorno's critique of modern society, especially after World War II, is so relentlessly negative.
Right. He argues that society is this kind of seamless web of domination, that everything is ideology, that the world is fundamentally false.
So here's the paradox, the question that has really dogged Adorno's scholarship for decades.
Okay, lay it out for us.
If the critique is that radical, if the whole system is corrupt, a kind of false totality, where do you get the standards from? What are the sources of normativity you're using to judge it as false in the first place?
How can you stand inside a prison, claim the prison's tools and language are all corrupted, and then somehow use them to make a case for justice? It feels self-defeating.
It's a classic self-authorization problem. And Gordon really grounds his whole exploration in a single phrase from Adorno himself. It's in the dedication to Minima Moralia.
This book of aphorisms, yeah.
Adorno says the book is devoted to exploring the doctrine of the right life in German. Die Lehre vom richtigen Leben. And he notes this is a subject modern philosophy has pretty much abandoned.
So that one phrase is the proof. It shows that no matter how negative he sounds, Adorno was always engaged in an ethical, a normative project.
Exactly. It was just buried very, very deep under layers of critique.
So to find that project, Gordon first has to clear away some of the big misinterpretations that have grown up around Adorno.
Right. Adorno himself was worried about this. In his Kant lectures from 59, he warns against these superficial slogans. He called it the Tauschwert, or the exchange value of an idea.
The exchange value, like the easy-to-digest, tweetable version of a philosophy.
That's a perfect analogy. It has high market value. You can trade it in academic circles, but it obscures the real content, the Gebrauchswert.
The use value, what the philosophy actually does to your thinking.
Precisely. And Gordon argues Adorno's popular reputation, his Tauschwert as a prophet of doom, doesn't match his actual Gebrauchswert. He has to take on this negativist interpretation head on.
The idea that he saw the world as totally false, a kind of mental concentration camp.
And one of the biggest critics pushing that line was Habermas.
His own student. What was Habermas's specific issue?
He accused Adorno of a performative contradiction. Habermas's whole thing is that modernity has to generate its own norms through, you know, rational communication. It has to authorize itself.
Right.
But Adorno's book, Dialectic of Enlightenment, seems to argue that the very process of rationalization has just wiped out all of that internal, immanent normative content.
So if reason itself is the tool of domination,
then using reason to critique domination is a contradiction. Your own theory pulls the rug out from under itself.
You're trapped. Your tools are as compromised as the thing you're trying to fix.
Then you have Axel Honneth coming at it from a more sociological angle. Honneth says, okay, maybe Adorno is implicitly relying on a sort of crude Freudian idea that our suffering is just a sign of blocked physical needs and impulses.
Just a biological cry of pain.
But if that's all it is, Honneth argues, you haven't given suffering any cognitive content. It's just a raw feeling, not a moral argument for why things should be different. It's an ungrounded norm.
It doesn't give you the intellectual resources to build a real critique of justice.
Exactly. Now, some people try to defend Adorno from within that negative box. Gordon brings up Fabian Feinhagen, who proposes this idea of negative Aristotelianism.
Negative Aristotelianism? That sounds complicated.
It is. It's a bit of an intellectual tightrope walk. Feinhagen's point is that you don't actually need to know what the good is. You don't need a blueprint for utopia.
Okay, so what do you need?
You just need to recognize our damaged, unrealized human potential. There's this theoretical ergon, the sort of fundamental human function, and we can see that it's being blocked or damaged by society.
So, like, you don't need the architect's plans to see that a building is crumbling. You can just see the cracks and the decay.
That's it. Recognizing the deficit is enough to know the present is false. And it's a strong defense, but Gordon's big move is to reject the premise that all these thinkers share.
Which is?
The idea that social reality is uniformly false.
Ah, why is that assumption total negativity itself an ideology for Adorno?
Yeah.
Because any totalizing view, whether it's the total affirmation of, say, Brave New World where everyone's happy, or total negation, they're both ideological. They present society as a seamless, closed system.
And in doing so, they cover up the real internal cracks and fissures, the recent brush you mentioned earlier.
Yes. If the world were perfectly seamlessly false, it would be perfectly administered. There'd be no room left for critical thought to even emerge. But critique does emerge.
Which brings us back to the self-reflexivity problem. The critic has to be part of the system. So Adorno must be practicing what he calls immanent critique.
Looking for those internal characteristics, those contradictions, that already point towards something better. The light has to be found inside the prison, however faint it is.
This helps explain that really famous and kind of confusing claim Adorno makes, exaggeration is the only medium of truth. That always sounds so over the top.
It does. It seems to contradict his sober sociological tone. But Gordon argues we should read it as anticipatory critique.
A warning.
Exactly. Adorno saw that modern systems, after Auschwitz, have this tendency toward total closure. Total catastrophe. So his critique isn't saying society is absolutely false right now. He's exaggerating to show us where we are heading.
Like dystopian fiction, projecting a possible horrible future to shock us into changing the present.
And the fuel for that critique comes directly from the Marxist tradition, specifically the idea of immanent contradiction, bourgeois ideals, freedom, equality, all of that.
They possess a normative surplus. I like that term. What does it mean in practice?
It means the promise baked into the idea, the ideal of true human emancipation, is always bigger than the system that created it. Think of liberty. It was used in 1789 to justify the rights of property-owning men.
But the idea itself, the surplus, couldn't be contained. It gets used later to argue for abolition, for women's suffrage.
Against the very systems that first championed it. So the ideal is both ideology, it legitimizes the ruling class, and at the same time, it's more than ideology. It contains a revolutionary seed.
And that's why Adorno has to reject Gnosticism, right? The idea that the world is just plain evil made by a flawed creator.
He found it compelling as a metaphor, you know, in art.
Yeah.
He loved Samuel Beckett for that reason. But he rejects it as a description of social reality.
Because if the world were a Gnostic prison, totally fallen.
Immanent critique would be impossible. You'd need a savior, some knowledge from outside the walls. But Adorno insists on staying inside history. He insists the world is full of these contradictions, these promises. The light must fall into the prison.
Okay, so that sets the stage. Let's move into chapter one of Gordon's book, where he really defines what this immanent critique looks like in practice.
Right. So chapter one is all about defining this practice. It's about refusing false affirmation, but doing so with an implicit reference to what a society worthy of humanity might look like.
And that reference point has to be found in our messy, compromised reality. Gordon finds the perfect metaphor for this in Beethoven's opera, Fidelio.
It's such a powerful image. In the final act, you have Florestan, the political prisoner, trapped in total darkness, total domination. And Adorno focuses on this feeble semblance of light, the Ohnmächtige Schein des Lichts, that penetrates the prison.
It's not this glorious divine light from heaven. It's weak, it's indirect, it's compromised by the dungeon it's shining into.
And Adorno says that is metaphysics. But it's a transformed metaphysics. It's lost its timeless, transcendent quality. The ideal of freedom is only potent when it's deeply embedded in history, fighting against the darkness.
This is why he breaks so hard with Hegel, isn't it?
Absolutely. Hegel's whole dialectic is about reconciliation, where every negative moment eventually gets absorbed into a meaningful, rational whole. For Adorno, after Auschwitz, that's not just a philosophical mistake. It's a moral outrage.
Yeah.
And injustice to the victims.
So critique has to be sustained by the opposite, by the non-identical, the things that don't fit, that resist being absorbed into the whole.
And this is where he makes that surprising link to Kant's thing in itself.
Which seems so counterintuitive. A materialist critique using a concept from transcendental idealism.
But Adorno sees a materialist motive in Kant. Remember, the thing in itself is Kant's way of saying there's an objective reality out there that our minds can never fully, completely grasp. It's a check on our subjectivity.
It stops our concepts from thinking they can explain everything.
Exactly. It's the irreducible objective moment. For Adorno, that's the non-identical. It's the material reality that resists our conceptual domination. If we could know and control everything, total administration would be complete. The non-identical is that point of resistance.
But then we run right into his famous line, there is no right life in the wrong. If this non-identical element appears within our wrong society, it can't be some pure, untouched island of truth.
And that's the tragedy of it. That's the precarity. When the non-identical appears in society, it is necessarily stained. It gets contaminated by the very system it's resisting.
So the source of hope is always in danger. It's always fragile.
He has to maintain that. If he claimed to have found a pure utopian space, he'd become a false prophet. And to show this in action, Gordon takes us to one of my favorite little bits of Adorno's writing, the toy store, the Kaufmannsladen.
This is a tiny aphorism from Minima Moralia, but it's so rich. Adorno's worried that the market reduces everything to exchange value, Tauschwert.
Right. Everything becomes abstract, quantifiable. It strips the world of its warmth, its magic.
But a child playing at having a store, they resist that logic completely.
They do. Their play is purposeless. Yeah. It's all about use value, Gebrauchswert. They take these objects of the market, toy money, toy products, and they strip them of their economic function. They're trying to redeem the things, to save what's good in them.
Gordon pulls out three themes here. The first is marginality.
The lesson is to look to the edges, to children's play, to art, to the things that the dominant system overlooks or excludes. That's where you'll find the truth.
Second, negativity.
The game itself is an act of negation. It resists the logic of exchange. It says no to the false reality of the adult world.
And third, and this is the big one for normativity, anticipation.
The very unreality of the game, the fact that it's all pretend, is a kind of proclamation that the real world of commerce is not yet real either. It's not the final form. The play is an unconscious exercise for the right life.
A fleeting glimpse. It's not the right life itself, but it's an anticipation of it.
And that tension is what Gordon calls imminent transcendence. The norms come from within our compromised world, imminent, but they point beyond it, transcendent. And because of that, truth and illusion are, for Adorno, inseparable.
This seems like a good place to transition to chapter two, where Gordon starts talking about a more solid, if still negative, ideal, human flourishing, menschliches Gedeihen.
Yes. And this begins with what he calls the emphatic concept of the human being, of Mensch.
What does he mean by emphatic?
He means it's not just a description of what a person is. It's an ideal of what a person could be, an ideal of absolute truth. So if you point to any specific individual, you know, a Hernex, and say he is a human being, you immediately feel a sense of
a deficit. That person, living in our unfree world, doesn't fully live up to the ideal of what a human being could be.
Exactly. The concept itself contains both the unfulfilled demand and the world's failure to meet it. That's how his concepts are dialectical.
And he makes this point so beautifully with that metaphor about color.
It's one of his clearest formulations. Consciousness could not despair over the grayness of the world unless it held the concept of a different color, whose scattered trace is not missing in the negative totality.
In other words, the very fact that we can feel despair about the grayness proves we have some concept of color. If the world were perfectly gray, we'd be colorblind. We wouldn't even notice.
That trace, that scattered hint of color, is the resource for critique and pushes back against this old philosophical idea that only the eternal and perfect can be true.
He rejects that clean separation between an idea's origin, its genesis, and its validity, its giltum.
He does. He's very Nietzschean here. Just because an ideal like freedom has a messy, self-interested historical origin, its genesis doesn't mean it loses its critical power or its validum, its validity.
The ideal can transcend its own flawed beginning.
It has to, for critique to work. This brings us to another one of these key normative concepts for him, happiness. Glück.
And he uses happiness as a kind of materialist guiding principle.
Yes, like a Kantian postulate. Mm-hmm. It's not a description of how things are, but a concept that guides our practice. He says all happiness we've experienced so far promises what has not yet been. It's always looking forward.
And this is where the title of Gordon's book, Precarious Happiness, really comes from. Why is it so precarious for Adorno?
Because for Adorno, true happiness demands complete vulnerability. A total openness to the risk of its being taken away. He remembers this children's song about two rabbits who escape a hunter by playing dead. That moment when they realize they're alive, that they survived, That's a flash of pure, unshielded happiness. It's only possible because of the immediate danger. It requires a kind of self-abandonment, letting go of the ego's tight control.
And this is his way of reworking Kant's morality.
A huge reworking. Kant, you know, made a very strict separation between the moral law, duty, and happiness, which he saw as a subjective desire.
Right. For Kant, you do the right thing because it's your duty, not because it'll make you happy.
And Adorno sees that split as a symptom of a kind of modern alienation. He says, no, we have to take Kant's idea of the highest good and reformulate it in purely materialist terms.
So the moral command, du sollst, thou shalt, has to be translated not as an abstract duty,
but as the demand for the right life. A demand for actual material human flourishing. And the absolute negative measure for that flourishing is suffering, the brute fact of pain. That's where critique gets its real-world traction.
That makes sense. That leads us very naturally into Chapter 3, which is all about Adorno's specific take on materialism and nature.
Yes, and this is where he grounds his philosophy in the body. For Adorno, humans are, first and foremost, sensual creatures. Our flourishing depends on satisfying our material needs, on maintaining contact with the warmth of things.
But that raises the tricky question of needs versus wants. How does he distinguish between what's a natural need and what's just a socially created desire?
He argues that distinction is itself a product of our current society, of class domination. He thinks our needs are historical. Once we move beyond a society based on class interest and scarcity, our very needs will fundamentally change.
So we can't really know our true needs from our current standpoint.
We can't. And to keep from falling into a simple biological reductionism, he brings in the concept of mimesis.
Mimesis, the sort of pre-rational organic impulse to imitate or assimilate with the other.
It's a key Frankfurt School idea. He says that civilization, the rational ego, is built on repressing this mimetic impulse. But in controlling external nature, we also diminish our own internal freedom. So true freedom requires reconnecting with that repressed, archaic part of ourselves.
You need both rational control and the ability to let go of that control.
A radical dialectic.
Yeah.
And we see fragments of this in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
He points to the act of giving a gift, Schenken.
Why is giving a gift so important for him?
Because it's a non-instrumental act. It defies the cold logic of exchange, of equivalence. He worries that if we lose the capacity for the gift, we lose our connection to our own organic nature. We become cold.
This all builds toward one of his most complex ideas, that the subject is also an object.
Right. We have to understand ourselves as beings in the world. Ein Seiendes. We have an irreducibly objective moment. We're not just pure thinking minds. We are bodies dependent on nature. And because of that, philosophy has to give priority to the objects.
How does he do that without just falling back into a kind of dogmatic realism?
Through self-reflection. The ideal is what he calls ein Gedenken der Natur im Subject, the remembering of nature within the subject. It's not about regressing to a primitive state. It's a mature, self-aware acknowledgement that we are part of nature, not its masters.
The moment you realize, I'm not just the boss here, I'm part of this ecosystem.
And that self-knowledge is what true freedom, true flourishing requires. It's the unity of the sensual and the spiritual.
Okay, this brings us to what Gordon argues is a central, not marginal, part of Adorno's whole project, his aesthetic theory. This is Chapter 5.
This is absolutely central. For Adorno, art is one of the last remaining spaces where a source of normativity can be found. It's where a kind of autonomy survives.
And this is where he famously disagreed with his friend Walter Benjamin.
A lifelong debate. Benjamin thought mass reproduction destroyed the artwork's unique aura. Adorno defended the autonomy of the artwork, calling it a sign of freedom, a Zeichen der Freiheit, that can survive even in an unfree world.
But doesn't that risk making art into this fetishized object in an ivory tower?
He's very careful about that. He's not talking about an artwork fetish. He applies that same dialectical logic we saw before. Every cultural object is a document of culture and a document of barbarism.
The beautiful cathedral is also a document of the exploited labor that built it.
Exactly. The autonomous artwork is itself antagonistic and split. It's born from the social contradictions it embodies.
And he links art to play, like he did with the toy store.
He does, drawing on Huizinga's Homo Ludens. Both art and play recognize the untruth of the true. They have this self-awareness of the world's ideological front. Think of Kafka or Beckett. The art knows it's entangled.
And its fundamental purpose, its material purpose, is to give voice to suffering.
Yes. Art is driven by the need to let suffering speak. Das Bedürfnis, Leiden werden zu lassen. especially in its modern dissonant forms, art becomes a kind of seismograph for social horror, a non-conceptual protest.
So if the artwork is autonomous, how does he still manage to analyze its social content?
It has a monadic character, an internal cohesiveness that gives the illusion of being sealed off. But in achieving that internal structure, Adorno argues, the artwork can't help but reproduce the logic of domination from the outside world, and immanent analysis reveals that social content.
So to be successful, to be truthful, art must be negative.
It has to remain unreconciled. If it presented a happy, harmonious picture, you would be lying about the state of the world. Even in Mozart, he says, you can hear a painful sweetness, a tension between the promise of harmony and the reality of suffering.
Which takes us to the final chapter of the book's analysis, chapter 6, which is all about the aesthetic experience. And it's here we really get to the heart of precarious happiness.
We do. And the model for Adorno's entire philosophical method here is Beethoven's Lied style, his Spade Still.
Why the Lied style specifically?
He contrasts it with Beethoven's heroic middle period. That music, he says, reflected the confidence of the early bourgeois subject. It projected this illusion of mastery, of a perfect harmony between the subject and the world.
An illusion of totality.
An illusion the late style completely shatters. The late works are fragmented. They're full of audible cracks and fissures, rifts and sprung. And those fragments become Adorno's model for how philosophy itself should work.
He has that great line, "One can no longer compose like Beethoven, but one must think like he composed."
It becomes a general aesthetic rule. The artwork must resist the neatness of conforming style, because style itself imposes a kind of uniformity. A broken world demands a broken art.
And we see this applied to other composers, like Mahler.
With Mahler, he hears the locus of a distressed nature. Mahler's use of folk sounds, of nature sounds, gives voice to the speechless, to the animals. It's an act of mimesis, retreating from rational control to save what has been silenced.
And in modern composers like Berg and Schoenberg, this reality is expressed through dissonance.
Dissonance is everything. It's not just a reflection of social horror. It is the core experience of precarious Gluck, precarious happiness. It is, he says, pain and happiness in one.
How can it be both at once?
As the overwhelming thing world of commodities demands our consent, the human spirit retreats into the aesthetic experience. It's a rudimentary minimum that preserves the memory of mimesis and offers this fleeting vision of freedom.
It's the simultaneous in-play of the negative and the utopian.
Yes. He sees it in Manet's colors, which express both something threatening, alarming, evil, and a kind of positive rapture. The happiness is only possible because you are simultaneously aware of its fragility, its entanglement with a negative reality.
But because the world remains unfree, the happiness can only ever be a promise.
And so all art, for Adorno, is tinged with trauer, with melancholy. The happiness it offers comes with a sigh, and oh, wäre es doch. Oh, if only it were so. It acknowledges the gap between the promise and the reality.
So to sum up Gordon's argument, Adorno is an anti-fundamentalist. His sources of normativity are damaged, precarious, fleeting, but they were absolutely necessary for any kind of immanent critique to get off the ground.
The precarity is the whole point. He doesn't need a utopia. He just needs the scattered traces. And this focus on material suffering as the negative bedrock leads to his final, most powerful moral statement.
His rewriting of Kant's categorical imperative.
Yes. He says that Hitler has imposed a new categorical imperative on humanity in our state of unfreedom, to arrange their thinking and acting so that Auschwitz does not recur, that nothing similar happens.
It's a devastatingly clear and direct demand. And he insists that this imperative is recalcitrant to rational justification. He says it's a sacrilege to even debate it. Why?
Because if you subject the command, "Do not commit genocide," to a philosophical debate, you imply that reason could potentially argue in favor of it. For Adorno, the imperative is imposed by the material fact of absolute suffering. It's not up for discussion. It is the negative anchor for all morality.
We might not know for certain what the right life is, but we know with absolute certainty what the wrong life is.
And this brings us to Gordon's final provocative thought. He contrasts Adorno's entire project with that of the other giant of 20th century German thought, Martin Heidegger.
And the contrast is stark.
It couldn't be starker. Adorno centers his entire philosophy on material suffering, on the vulnerability of the human body. Heidegger, especially after the war, moves away from humanism entirely. His philosophy becomes about being itself, not human beings.
So Heidegger's famous concept of being towards death is not about physical suffering at all.
Not at all. It's an abstract ontological experience of authenticity, completely divorced from the messiness of history or physical pain. This focus on the hardness of fate led him to an ethic that was, well, an empty kind of self-affirmation that refused to explicitly condemn the Holocaust.
Whereas Adorno's new imperative demands precisely that we act against the conditions that produce that kind of material historical suffering.
It's a profound difference. Heidegger offers a retreat from human affairs. Adorno demands a total mobilization of our critical faculties to fight oppression.
Which leaves us with Adorno's challenge, which feels just as relevant today. If the structural conditions for barbarism, the coldness of the market, the suppression of our connection to nature are already embedded in our normal society, how radically do we need to change our thinking and our acting to make sure nothing like that ever happens again?